$100 million in total cumulative sales. We built this? Like, that's insane.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. Imagine launching a company with your three childhood best friends. Now imagine that business is about to hit $100 million in lifetime revenue. Dan Dembski is one of the co-founders and the current CEO of Unbound Marino.
I just had to make the decision that I was going to go all in and live on fumes. I, in my heart of hearts, knew this thing can and should work.
100% super fine merino wool and elevated designs you can wear over and over again without worrying about wear and tear.
There's a million places to buy a t-shirt, but ours helps you pack light. It was a message that we thought was powerful enough to stand above the rest.
30% of customers return within the first month to buy more, and they've just scratched the surface in women's apparel. Dan, great to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
You and your two other co-founders are friends. Your best friends. In fact, you've been best friends since high school?
Before, since elementary school.
Do you consider them like a board of directors? Like if you need direction as a CEO, who do you go to?
It's a good question. I'm always seeking guidance and I don't have this official board. Like here's my board. I go to them when I have questions. I feel like I have people everywhere for any purpose. So if it's a marketing related thing, like here's the suite of people I know and I can pick up the phone.
What do you think about these like organizations for entrepreneurs, YPO, EO? Are you in something right now?
I just joined Founders Club.
What's Founders Club?
It's similar to EO. We'll see. We'll see if I like it. I mean, it's important to get involved in things like that, like EO or YPO or Founders Club or any of these things. It's because it just exposes you to the people who have figured that thing out. I might have a leadership challenge or an operational one, but I've spent a lot of time meeting a lot of people over the years. So I don't think of any one group as my go-to. I just sort of go out to the network and that's helped me a lot over the years.
How long have you been an entrepreneur now, would you say?
I think it's been in my blood since I was born. I've been scheming since I was a kid and that's kind of entrepreneurial behavior, but legitimately starting an actual business since my early 20s. I never went and got a job somewhere and then started a business and left my job. I just started as an entrepreneur as far as my career goes. So probably since I was about 20.
You know, you began as an entrepreneur in your 20s. Were you in university? Is this like post-university? And were you doing well in school? Was school not a fit for you?
I never did that well in school. I had moments where I did well. It's interesting. Looking back, it's like sometimes I'd get really, really excited by a subject and I do really well that semester. And I think that's a pretty surefire sign of ADD. If I was into it, or ADHD, I was really into it. But if I wasn't engaged, I was lousy and I was a C student. So I didn't even get into university, but I was pretty heartbroken that I didn't get into university because I felt like a failure. And I spent that year working, trying to save a little bit of money, didn't really save much. And I thought I'm going to go back into school. And I went and I did a joint program with Seneca and York University. I lasted a semester being interested. Then I did one more semester where I started to become disinterested. But all the while, I was doing all these little side projects and hustles. And I started my first business kind of inadvertently. Me and my best friend, Justin, were doing a bunch of video production stuff. And we loved it. And we got really good at it. So we started doing these little projects for $100 or $200. And then it grew to $500. And then we got really busy because we were working really hard. We'd shoot the videos. We'd spend all night editing. We'd really cared about what we were delivering. So people told other people about us and the phone kept ringing. And then we needed to start hiring help because we had so much work to do that we couldn't handle it all ourselves. So I was running this out of my mom's basement with Justin. And then we brought a friend Andrew in and Andrew started working with us. And then we brought more people in and all of a sudden, this little operation was happening in my mom's basement. And it was never like we went out with the intent of starting a business. We just wanted to get all the work done. But then the client base started growing. And then it, you know, from these small businesses became medium businesses. Then it became big corporations. And we sat back like, whoa, I think we're a company. Fast forward 2 years, we were downtown in a big studio and there was 15 of us. And it was a legitimate company. And we never intended for that. But that was sort of the start of it. all the while I was still in school and I was working at as an intern at a radio station and I was working at a restaurant. It was like nonstop and something had to give. And the obvious first thing to go was school. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, this is the most useless thing out of everything I'm doing. So mm-hmm. I left school and never went back.
This is Biz Media.
Mm-hmm.
That's the video production company.
Correct.
Okay. So Unbound gets kicked off in 2016, but the idea for Unbound doesn't happen in 2016. It happens somewhere between 2013 and 2016. How did the idea get seeded?
So this business that I started in my mom's basement, the ride to grow to where we grew was amazing. I was working with my friends. We out of nowhere had all these employees. We had this really cool space. The video company. Okay. But after those first few years, which were so exciting and felt like I grabbed onto the side of a rocket ship, I started to hate it because I didn't know how to hire salespeople. And I was the only person who knew how to do our little pitch and do our song and dance and get the customer to sign on the dotted line and give a deposit check. And because we didn't know what we were doing, we grew this company so fast and we had all these mouths to feed. That exciting thing that we had before when we were feeling the growth became dread because we weren't closing deals because they're exciting anymore. We were closing deals because we had to keep the lights on. Mm. And it was this constant pressure. And I started just feeling like I can't do this forever. Like, I don't know the way out of this. Like, how did I get myself into this? Meanwhile, I'm seeing my friends who start these e-commerce businesses and they're scaling in a totally different way. So while I'm grinding it out there to get sales for Biz Media, our video agency, and the team is grinding out to do the production work, it felt like we would charge this much and we'd have to do this much work. It was a perfect trade. It was one for one, for one for one. You always had to work. It was long hours, always closing deals. If I went on a trip, I'd have cash flow problems in a few months.
Because you're not closing.
If I wasn't closing.
Yeah.
So it was like you only can charge as much value as you can give. Whereas my e-commerce friends, they were grinding to do some marketing and some stuff to get their product out there. And then they go to sleep. And while they go to sleep, that little Shopify cha-ching, cha-ching, it's just going. It's just going while they're sleeping. And I always thought about that. I used to go to bed at night feeling like my business is stopping because I'm going to bed. Whereas my buddies with the e-commerce businesses, that cash register is ringing all night because the work they did to get it out there continues to work for them. Word of mouth, people come back and they just keep buying. And I thought, I need to find a way to get a product. I don't know what it is, but I need to find a product. So I went on and I thought about that for probably about 2 years. I'd get together with the guys and we'd have a scrap piece of paper or we'd go to a chalkboard or we'd have a little whiteboard and we'd just come up with ideas.
Your co-founders.
Yeah, these are my best friends. It's just like, let's come up with a product idea. No idea what it is. Literally anything we could think of. The ideas, some of them might have been great. A lot of them were terrible, but any idea was good enough to just table and discuss.
Are they entrepreneurs or are they working?
They're working at Biz Media. We all worked together back then.
Oh, you all were involved.
So Justin was my business partner. Andrew and Dima worked for the company. Dima left and worked at an ad agency, but we were just ideating together.
Got it.
Just different groups of people. This is what we'd do when we'd go out. Mm. We'd go for a beer and we'd come up with ideas. Mm. Some of these ideas were terrible. I mean, here's a bad idea. Andrew thought we should start a pickle company. The reason he thought we should start a pickle company is because he always joked that I look like a pickle. He's like, you'd be a perfect mascot. Pickles. And then we thought that would be who buys pickles online? Terrible to ship. Bad idea. Scrap it.
It's funny. We're in a forum with a founder CEO of a very large, well-known pickle brand.
Yeah.
So that's funny that came all first full circle. Didn't involve you at all. But yeah. I never knew that.
Go on. But that was just one of the ideas. So what I'm trying to say is we're just throwing stuff at the wall. We never came up with an idea that had legs, just enough to have some more conversations. But because I was constantly thinking about what could that idea be, it was almost like I had this deep intention set in my mind. I'm going to find a product to sell. And I'm looking at all my friends who have e-commerce businesses. I'm seeing the ones that are working and the ones that aren't. And I'm thinking, what's my thing? What's my thing? Then I went on this trip. I was in Hydra, Greece. I think cruise ships now stop there, but like a little, port island in Greece, right out of like a 40-minute ferry from Athens, I think, roughly. And it's beautiful. And What's cool about it is there's no roads. So because there's no roads, there's no cars. It's just this hill. And you go up the hill, and we had this hotel kind of like, you know, midway up the hill. And I was with my then girlfriend, and she had this big suitcase and I had a medium suitcase, and our hotel was kind of up the top of that hill. And I was looking at these donkeys you can hire. You can put your suitcases on the donkey and pay them. And I'm like, I'm not paying a donkey. I'm going to carry these up myself. Of course, her suitcase, my suitcase. And we started walking up this hill. And by the time we got up there, I'm just sweating bullets. And we threw those suitcases on the bed and opened them up. And I looked at her and said, how much stuff in your suitcase are you actually wearing? And she's like, honestly, probably 25% of it, max. And I'm like, okay, next time we go anywhere, carry-ons only. Can we do that? And she's like, sure. So that became my mission. I don't care where I'm going. I'm going to pack in a carry-on. And whatever our next trip ended up being, it was somewhere in Southeast Asia. I was trying to figure out, how do I pack all my clothing into a carry-on and still be able to go away for a couple weeks? So I started looking online and I found this Reddit thread about how to pack with just a carry-on for overseas travel. Mm-hmm. And the tip was, use merino wool clothing because it's antibacterial, it's odor resistant. So you could rewear the same shirt multiple times. And then instead of needing to pack 14 t-shirts for your trip, you could pack 3 or 4. You'll need less space, you can have less stuff, and you can have a carry-on. You can have just a backpack if you want. And I think, perfect. I need to find merino wool t-shirts. I didn't even know merino wool was a thing. So where I lived in Toronto at the time was right near all the stores where you can get merino wool, like all the outfitters, like the backpacking outfitters kind of stores, Mech, Patagonia. And I started going around trying to find merino wool t-shirts. And I'll never forget the first merino wool t-shirt I touched. I went to the rack and I asked, I said, where's the merino wool t-shirts? I said, oh, there's a whole section over there. And I grabbed this t-shirt and there was a Timberwolf on it, howling at the moon, like, and it said, live free. And it was like $100. You know, when you're back in school, there's like a lost and found box.
Yeah, it was in that box.
It was there. Like yeah. They just took it out and they're saying $100.
Totally bucks. Hideous. No one wants it.
Yeah. It's like, I'm like, who's buying this? So I started trying to find a plain, nice fitting t-shirt that was made in merino wool. And the only thing I could find were these boxy outdoors t-shirts or base layers that were like skin tight kind of thing. And I ended up buying a couple of these shirts and they weren't really nice, but whatever, I'll make do with them. And I went on this trip and I remember being in this cocktail bar and I'm looking around and I'm seeing all these people around me and they're all dressed like really cool. You know, they're dressed to go out, they're dressed to have their martini. And I'm wearing this shirt that looks like I should be walking with a canoe over my head, like portaging. And then like, I feel so out of place. Mm. And like, why is no one making merino wool t-shirts that you can dress up a little bit? So I can still go on that hike during the day and have that performance, but I can go out. Because when I travel, I'm going to cocktail bars at night. That's my scene. I'd rather go to a jazz club or a cocktail bar than be in a tent. That's just me. So I need stuff that works for me. So I went looking all over for merino wool t-shirts that can be a little bit more stylish. And I couldn't find it. And then it just hit me. I've been spending the last 2 years trying to find a product to sell. This is it. Because if Unbound Merino existed when I was looking, I would just be a customer.
Right.
So I thought there has to be more people out there like me.
So you go back to Justin, Andrew, Dima with this idea. And are they as excited as you are about it?
Well, this was an interesting part of my life because I had my first business with my best friend, Justin. And the other guys worked in the company. And we were all planning on like, let's come up with another idea. But Justin didn't want to do it because he had a new mortgage and he had a new baby. And I'm like, hey, let's blow it all up and start from scratch. That made sense for me at the time. For him, it's like, I can't do that. And I realized, I'm like, I can't do this with him because he wanted to stay and continue to service the clients of Biz Media, which made perfect sense. He had a family now. And I'm like, I want to go all in on something. So in the ideation stage, we were all just talking about it. But when it came down to actually building this thing and trying to make it a business, I had to make the choice. Well, I need to do this with people who want to go all in on something. And Andrew and Dima, my business partners, this is what we've done forever. We were always scheming, you know, we used to go to Phish concerts and make t-shirts and sell them in the parking lot to get from one show to the other. Like it wasn't like a hard pitch to be like, hey, you want to try this thing? It was just, hey, here's an idea. Let's put our energy into it. I was like, yeah, let's do it. There was never this, hey, let's go start a business. It was just this project. Do you want to give it a shot? Yeah, let's give it a shot.
So you all go, as you point out, all in. Does that mean you incubate this company, you decide you're going to do this crowdfunding campaign, which is inning one, right? And that is the first chapter. Like this is 2016, at least the crowdfunding campaign, if I got my timeline right, on Indiegogo happens in 2016. Is that where this thing starts to become an actual brand, an actual company?
Well, when we had the idea, and the reason we decided to do the crowdfunding campaign is because we didn't really have a lot of time. We had no capital of our own to be able to put into this thing. Barely had energy. Crowdfunding campaign worked perfectly for us because it allowed us to sort of work on this thing as a side hustle while we still ran Biz Media. So we would work on it every Friday night for a year and a half, where we had to figure out, how do we source manufacturing? What is this brand going to be called? How are we going to get photography for it? How do we make a prototype? All this stuff. Like, it was a blank slate. We had no idea how to do any of this. But the crowdfunding campaign gave us the framework to be able to figure out what the brand is, what the value proposition is, and how we pitch it, and what the copywriting is going to be, what the photography and design is going to look like. But also, we had to go figure out how to get an actual prototype. So we had to source manufacturing. So we were able to sort of just meet up every Friday night. And it was only once a week because we had other jobs and other businesses. And Dima just had a baby. So he had, you know, responsibilities there with his family. So we had to wait until his babies went to bed. And we'd show up at his house every Friday at like 8 p.m. or whatever time it was. And we'd work until we were either too tired or we had too much whiskey. Once a week for a year and a half until the crowdfunding campaign was done. And our goal of the crowdfunding campaign was just, do we have product market fit? This is the way I looked at it. This thing's either going to work and we'll have made our dream business, or it won't, and I'll have a box of prototype t-shirts that I wanted anyway. I'm like, this is win-win. I'm getting my t-shirts or I'm getting this whole business. It's enough to take a step. I'm like, I didn't even care if it failed because at least I tried. I kid you not. And I'm not just saying this because I'm on the Shopify Masters podcast. If it didn't work, I was going to go apply for a job. And I'm like, I think I could convince Shopify to hire me. It's the only place I'd want to work. I don't even have a resume, but I'm like, I'm going to go get a job if this doesn't work. So this is like my Hail Mary. This is going to work or I'm done with entrepreneurship.
I think at the time when you guys launched the crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo, you set a goal of something like 30 grand, was it, to raise, right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you do what?
Like 400. Yeah.
So you 10X, but yet you somewhat lacked the confidence to say to yourselves, like, this is a smashing success.
No. I don't think I did. I mean, I had another business. I had to figure out what was going to happen there. And there was a moment in which I decided, okay, I'm just going to go all in. Now, I was in my 30s and I'm starting from scratch. This new business. I mean, we did 400 grand in our crowdfunding campaign, but it didn't have money for me to draw a salary. Like, that went to inventory and trying to get this thing started. All the money went back in for a long period of time. I just had to make the decision that I was going to go all in and live on fumes. In that era of my life, I was going to the grocery store and checking my bank account before I went to make sure, like, I knew how much money I could spend on groceries. Like, I evaporated my savings and I started from scratch. Now, it sounds like, that's intense. At the time, I'm like, no, this is perfect. It didn't even faze me. But I had to make the decision that I'm going all in on this. And I had to say to my best friend, who was my business partner, like, I'm going here now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can have this company. I didn't sell it. I didn't want anything from it. In fact, we even had some lingering debts that we had to pay together. So, like, we'll clean this up and I'm just going to go start this thing. And I was in the worst financial situation of my life, completely happy. That's the way my brain works. I'm like, I, in my heart of hearts, knew this thing can and should work.
Mm-hmm.
So just give it all I can. But I did have this transition period where I had to figure out, what am I doing with all these other projects? When I went all in, it continues to this day to feel like I always have so much to do and so much purpose, and I'm so in it and having fun. But I just love this stuff. So it was really exciting for me to go all in. It didn't matter about the money.
How did you source the products? How did you source your supplier?
When we first started, we had no idea how to do this. I mean, we found our supplier as an Alibaba. And I remember looking at just like endless amounts of suppliers, and they say they do everything. So I type in merino wool, and you can see all of them do merino wool. And I'm like, you don't know who's lying and who isn't. So I remember having this questionnaire that asked everything that I could ask to sort of qualify if they might be a supplier that could work with us, including like obvious questions like, what are your minimum order quantities? And we didn't even know what our order quantities would be, because we didn't even have a crowdfunding campaign yet. So if they said 10,000 pieces, I'm like, we can't work with them. But if they said 500, we thought maybe we can. And we sent probably, no joke, 500 inquiries on Alibaba. And from that, let's say 100 got back to us. And from those 100, maybe 20 seemed like we could even talk to them, because maybe we could meet their minimum order quantities, or there didn't seem to be a language barrier we couldn't deal with, or whatever it was. And from those 20 that we started talking to, 5 of them we really liked, and we got samples. From those 5, 3 of them seemed good, and we ended up working with 2 of them. One of them, which we still work with today, that was our main supplier. And we didn't know any of the steps on how you make sure that you get quality. We were so paranoid that we were going to mess it up, because you hear a lot of horror stories. Mm-hmm. You put in your order and then it doesn't come to spec, or it's lower quality, and then you're screwed and then you're out of business. So we were paranoid. So we told them, when production happens, we're going to be on the production floor. And this was in China. So we're going to be there. Is that okay? This and that. And we constantly communicated. And we did. We showed up. So when they were making our first run of clothing, we were standing there. And I'm like measuring it with a measuring tape. And I put it on. I wore it for a week in Shanghai. And I sweated and I tested it. And I'm like, the whole thing. It's funny looking back, because if you see how QA is actually done, it's incredibly comprehensive. Like they do pages and pages of testing and cutting and weighing and all this stuff. And we're just these dummies in there with like a measuring tape. Like, and they're probably looking at us like, these guys have no idea what they're doing. But we were there, and we got to become friends with them. And I think being friends with them made it so they wanted to see us win. We're actually friends with them. Like, we got invited to their family weddings.
Wow.
So our paranoia forced us to go and meet these people. And I think that initial relationship was like a safeguard for us to make sure we got quality.
What was the positioning of the brand early on in 2016? Was it for travelers? Was it a fashion brand? Like, what was it?
We sell a benefit. The benefit is that you will be able to be more free and more spontaneous when you travel, because you'll have less stuff. And that is always the primary focus of our messaging and our marketing, more so than like cool stuff. Like, we're not a fashion brand. People say, hey, here's Dan, he's a founder of a fashion brand. And every time I hear that, I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, this is a tool for me. Because for me, I'm like, I want to have nice clothing, but I don't need to be on trend. I don't need to know what's happening in fashion. I'm like, I just want a great t-shirt that's made of the best material with the best fit that works for me. It serves the purpose that I need. And that could be for travel, but also just regular life. But we kept the niche of travel because it's so easy to communicate. Here's why you buy our stuff. I mean, there's a million places to buy a t-shirt, but ours helps you pack light. It was a message that we thought was powerful enough to stand above the rest in a red ocean of apparel companies.
The first slogan was pack less, travel more.
Pack right? less, experience more.
Experience more.
And that's what's really at the core of what we stand for. We sell t-shirts and other clothing, but we're a t-shirt brand, and we've always looked at ourselves as selling freedom and experience, or the ability to focus on what matters. Like, that's at the core of what we are. It's in the name, unbound of like your stuff, so you can be free. You know, the whole business model is built on the same principle of like, that's why we're remote. It's like, we want to be able to live how we want to live. And that's the spirit of Unbound.
And then you have this hiccup, which is COVID. It feels like it's a travel-oriented brand. At least that feels like the first version of the positioning. And then the pandemic hits and you have to reposition Unbound to something else.
When you have a travel product, I guess the worst thing that could happen is a global travel ban. It was kind of insane. I was like, whoa, we didn't put this on our threats and our SWOT analysis. Yeah. Sort of blindsided us. And our sales did dry up immediately.
Yeah.
So we were growing so fast then that I think we started to get a little lax with how we were spending, like hiring coaches. And like, it's like, because we kept growing. So we felt like, let's just keep layering on whatever we need to do to fuel this growth. And then all of a sudden, when the sales dried up, we're like, whoa, stop. All superfluous spending. Like, let's like comb through this. Let's like get rid of everything and just be as lean as we can. Cause we started to realize we have no idea how long this thing is going to last. And like the survival of our business relied on it. So we had all of this advertising that we set up and all this marketing and all of this website copy. And the whole positioning was, we help you pack less so you can experience more. Now this messaging is useless. The meta advertising algorithms were all based around stuff that worked for travel ads. All useless. All of our best ads don't work. Nothing works. And our sales just tanked. And we felt like we had to go into the war room and figure out like what, how do you deal with this? We kind of like as much of this superfluous spending as we could. And we just focused our energy on this slight pivot to focusing on the features of the clothing instead, like how comfortable it is and breathable and anything that didn't really relate to travel, but it's like the thing before the benefit. There's a whole sales thing where it says features, advantages, benefits. So the features are just like, it's a t-shirt, it's this weight, it's this color, whatever. And the advantages are, well, it's antibacterial and it's odor resistant. And then the benefits are you can pack less stuff and you're live freer. That's the stuff you want to sell on because people can put themselves, they can envision their lives with those benefits. And we always sold on benefits and we're like, now we're going to sell on features for a bit. And that was a really weird time for all businesses because while if you're in the travel business, everything is sinking. However, if you're in the e-commerce business, everything was growing. So more people were buying stuff online, but they weren't buying travel stuff. So we had this kind of weak messaging, but so many people were buying stuff online that we were able to kind of stay afloat. And we were used to this huge explosive growth from year one. But when COVID hit, at the end of that year, we grew 1%. And I remember looking at that and thinking, we grew. I don't care it's 1%. Like if this was under normal circumstances, that growth rate would be abysmal compared to what we were used to. We were growing over 100% every year that since we started the company. And now 1%, I'm like, you know what? I'll take it. We looked at that as a win. And I think it almost helped make our business better and more bulletproof because we realized we don't need to spend on all these things we were spending on. We could be smarter and leaner. And that carried into the years ahead. We'll do 60 million this year.
60 million.
Yeah.
Which in and of itself is insane in under a decade. So in 9 years. And what's interesting about your business, and you're talking about Meta, and you were very early to Meta, I'd say very early to paid ads there, and we're investing there in terms of customer acquisition and growth. And yet that still remains the predominant channel.
We're spending more than $20,000 a day on Meta.
A day. So in a way, what I find interesting is, yes, you have these challenges and these bumps in the road, but by and large, the business has still continued to grow at this steady clip. And in terms of, so the general foundation of the business is the same. It's still e-com, it's still D2C. Most of your customers are coming through Meta. Do you feel like there's a certain consistency to your strategy that you've held to that's responsible for the success that you've had?
We're always looking for new opportunities in marketing. So it's not just Meta. Meta is just the biggest spend by far, and it's done the most for us, and we figured it out the most. We had a huge period where Meta was kind of flatlined. It still was pretty significant for us, but we weren't increasing the spend. And again, these entrepreneur communities I'm involved in, you end up meeting people who are like, what are you doing? Like, you could be doing so much more here. You should be doing more creative. And let me show you how this company is doing it. And I just learned things along the way. So with Meta, we just tinkered and tried to figure out how can we continue to add more ad spend while maintaining a good return on ad spend, ROAS. And our ROAS was high. It was like over 4. So I'm like, we should just spend more. Like, if we break even on the first purchase, I think that's worth it because the customers come back. We know that. With a 4 ROAS, we're quite profitable on the first purchase. I'm like, just keep scaling. Keep scaling until it's break even. Mm. So we slowly start scaling and scaling, adding more creative, finding winners. And we just ended up figuring out this system where, like, by adding more and more ads and making more iterations of the winning ads and killing the loser ads and just really staying on top of it, we can just add a little bit of budget every week. So we do 1.5% every single week we add. And our ROAS has never dipped below 3. Like, it just keeps going. So, the challenges become, like, projecting how much are we going to sell and making sure we have the right inventory and all the inventory planning. But that kept just growing, and we sort of figured that out with a really good system. All the while, we're still trying TikTok, Google's really good for us, influencer and affiliate. Some of these with pretty good success. They're not as big as Meta, but pretty successful. And some of them we're terrible at. We're terrible at TikTok. Hmm. And we laugh every quarter. We're like, all right, what's our TikTok strategy? Because we just keep throwing money at it. We can't figure it out. But the way I look at marketing is like you're walking down like a hallway with a million doors. There's a million opportunities, and you kind of got to just nudge the door open with your foot. See, is there something in there? Nope. Just keep going. You have to never stop trying. And sometimes if you just keep doing that, you open a door and you're like, boom, here it is. Some amazing insider opportunity or win. And we're always just constantly trying new things. So Meta, we've unlocked and figured out how to scale it. And that's a huge part of our business now. But we don't rest on our laurels because, I mean, sometimes the algorithm stops working for a bit. We can't have all our eggs in that basket. So we're always looking. Where are the influencers? Where are the affiliates? How do we figure out TikTok? Is Pinterest worth trying? We're always just trying everything.
When you say that your goal is to break even on the first purchase, right? So let's say you're at net zero. You're hoping for the long tail, right? You're hoping for some lifetime value, some repeat purchase behavior. What do you do to win back those customers, to bring those folks back for a repeat purchase?
Depending on who you ask, you're going to get a different answer to this question. Some people are going to say, well, you got to have a really good email flow that cross sells and this and that. This stuff all helps, but it really just comes down to quality of the product. That is the thing that gets people to come back. So we obsess over that because people will typically try one t-shirt and then they'll try it on and then they'll buy 3 t-shirts, a long sleeve and a hoodie. The second purchase is bigger, or they're just buying more of the same. But if we were making a bad product, no one's coming back. So I think as far as lifetime value and retention goes, that's the thing. Everything else is fluff. The quality of what you're selling matters. Everything else is just an optimization.
What do you think is the most promising acquisition opportunity beyond Meta, if you were to have to predict?
People are always looking for that easy answer, but I mean, it depends. It depends on what you're selling. If you're selling something like chocolate bars or something, you might be best off selling it on Amazon, you know, and doing Amazon marketing, or maybe it's influencer stuff. It just depends on your business. I just don't think for any particular business you can say, this is the best opportunity. I think you have to do what I said, is just try everything always. It's always on creative exercise to try to figure out how to make it click and find that product market fit.
I think that's challenging for a lot of brands when they have, as you point out, have unlocked something. So if you know Meta's working and you can just double your ad spend there and generate north of 4-to-1 ROAS or north of 3-to-1 ROAS, why kick in all these other proverbial doors and risk marketing dollars there?
Even on Meta, you're risking marketing dollars. So the whole strategy is to double down on the ads that are working and make other iterations of those. All the while, you need to be doing creative testing of new stuff. The best ads you have will atrophy at some point. If you're not filling the pipeline with new concepts and figuring out which ones are duds and which ones have potential, then when your other ads atrophy, your whole account's going to dry up. So even on Meta, you're taking risks. That's what marketing is. It's taking swings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get winners, sometimes you get losers, but you got to keep trying. And it's fun, but you should be trying everything.
So you're now up to $20,000 a day on Meta, roughly. What works? What doesn't?
Well, when you spend $20,000 a day on ads, you have to be like really on top of what's working, what doesn't. And really, sometimes, here's what I learned. The stuff that you get most attached to creatively, that stuff doesn't work. The stuff that you think is sort of like really like pitchy and like kind of cheesy, that works. One thing, unfortunate for me, that seems to work is stuff with a founder in it. So they keep putting me in videos, and that gets uncomfortable sometimes when you're spending that much money on ads and people start to like, they recognize me, but they don't know where they know me from. Huh. So I'll be sitting in a sauna and someone will be like staring over at me. And I remember one time I was so uncomfortable. And the guy was like, "You're that guy from the internet, aren't you?" Like, oh, I hate this. The trends change so fast. If you asked me this 3 months ago, I'd say the user-generated content look is like, that would work. And now it's starting to not. Pictures sometimes work. I can't tell you today what works and that be applicable in a month. It's constantly changing and shifting. And the approach is that you have to be on top of it and see every single day how things are going and start dropping things and adding things and tweaking things. But in general, some trends will stick. And I think the founders thing or the people that work at the company, that stuff's doing really, really well.
Dan, you've been the CEO of the business all the while.
Mm-hmm.
But you said earlier that this is the first time that you're actually going to behave like a CEO.
When you have five people on your team and you call yourself a CEO, it's like, technically you could put what you want on your business card, but are you really?
Right.
I think there's a difference between being a founder or an entrepreneur and a CEO. You have to figure out what a CEO is at some point, because where we're at in business right now, all of these founder qualities I have, that optimism, that appetite for experimenting with new things, it's basically chasing shiny objects, is not that helpful to the team right now. I get excited by shiny objects all the time. It's still my thing. Every quarter I come up with new ideas of we should try this thing. And it's not in line with the plan of the business, but it's worth talking about. But what the team really needs is me to remind everyone where we're going, what the vision of the company is, to make sure we're doing the right things to get there, to make sure they're looked after and they have the resources they need to execute, that they feel they have autonomy and they have my support and the team support. And I'm starting to learn that these leadership qualities of CEO are the things that are completely new to me that I need to develop. And I'm crossing that line from founder to CEO, and I'm loving it. It's a new challenge. And I want to be the CEO of this company, but I have to work really hard and learn a lot to be worthy of the team, because the team's amazing that we have. So I feel like it's a whole new identity. I'm leaving like this entrepreneur founder personality that comes completely easy to me. And I'm learning that new skill set. So now I'm giving myself permission to be that, and I'm trying to own it. And, you know, I used to be uncomfortable saying CEO, and it felt like it was like, it made me cringe to say it because I started saying it too early in the company. I didn't feel like a CEO. And now I feel like it, and I'm going to own it, and I'll learn to be great at it. And that's an everyday learning experience.
It takes a very different set of skills and leadership traits to start something versus scale something versus optimize something, right? Like that profile is different, right? And very few individuals are good at all of those phases, right? Are good at the founding phase, are then good at the scale up phase, are then great at the optimization phase. I think that is a really tough transition for a lot of founders, which is why a lot of founders cycle out of a business and then a business brings on, you know, perhaps they bring on investors and they bring on a different CEO or a different set of senior execs or whatever. For you, as you step into that transition and think about the qualities that you need to be a good CEO, and you talked about the idea of having certain leadership qualities that you're working on, what does that mean?
There was a phase where I sort of had to ask myself, do I even know what a CEO is? I started Googling it, putting it into ChatGPT. Like, what is a CEO anyway? And there's so many different ways you could show up as a CEO in different styles. Some are very operational. Some are very marketing heavy. I really just wanted to figure out, like, what does a good CEO look like? What would I have to be for the people on my team to talk about me when I'm not there and be like, our CEO he's awesome. Like, he established like the best culture in which we can work and thrive. And I remember we sat down with our VP product, who I think is one of the most talented people I've ever met. In one of our first one-on-ones, I asked her, I said, basically what I just said to you. I'm like, what would it take for you to think I'm a great CEO? Because I'm going to be honest with you, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. And she's like, it's this. It's just, you give the time to like hear me out and talk, and you want me to thrive. I don't micromanage. I have a lot of trust in the people. I feel like it's very important to give people autonomy and the feeling like they can make their own decisions and they can make mistakes. I get out of the way. I prefer it that way. Some people say it's hard for the founder to let go of the work. I take it. I don't want it. You do it. I hire people who are better than me at the thing. Well, who am I to say, like, no, this is how you should make clothes, to a person who's done it for 20 years for all these amazing brands? I just know what our brand's supposed to be. So what I've come to realize is I just need to make sure that I'm fostering a culture where people feel like they know this is what our brand is, and you have autonomy in helping us achieve whatever these things are, and do your work, do your best work here. We'll support it. And getting out of the way and just knowing that I should stay out of the way almost all the time, but know those times when I should go in there and help and be of assistance. It's just this process. I'm just learning day by day by day. There's always a zillion things to do. But one of the things I realize that is the most valuable is just being present, not overbearing, just there, checking in, giving praise where it's actually due, and making sure the strategy is really tight. Like, we know where we're headed, what we need to do this year, as far as like things we need to accomplish, metrics we need to hit, and then just asking the questions. Are we on track? Are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? Cool. That sounds like a great plan. Just being, I think I'm partly a cheerleader. Just like, this is great. And I mean it though. Like, I really just, I see the team around me. I'm like, this is amazing. And I think that's the one thing that I have done really well. My partners have also have done really well, is we are thrilled to let people just do everything on their own without getting in their way.
Over the course of the company's life cycle, you will have done cumulatively roughly $100 million in revenue. You'll do $60 million in top-line revenue this year alone. And a very large percentage of that $60 million, north of 50% or something like that, is coming from women only.
Yeah, 2 years ago, we launched women's, and it surpassed men's already.
How?
Well, first of all, women buy a lot more stuff. That's the true answer. We had so many women customers before we had women's clothing because they were buying the stuff for their husbands, boyfriends, sons, right, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we're getting all these emails saying, where's women's clothing? Where's women's? So that was why we did it. We kept getting emails. We kept getting Instagram comments, Instagram DMs, constantly saying, where's the women's line? And like, guys, clearly there's a demand here. Let's take a stab at this. And then it's just a matter of getting it right. But once it was there, just like launching our Shopify store, we had sales right away because we already had the crowdfunding campaign behind us. So there was like a bit of word of mouth that existed. Once we launched, it was off to the races, and it just took a life of its own. It wasn't hard to get into that market. It was obvious that the market was ready for it because they were telling us.
Do you look back and say, why didn't we do this, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago?
I never thought of that, to be honest. I think we did it at the time when we were ready to do it. I mean, of course I can say, oh, we should have gone in earlier, we'd have made more money faster, but it's just the truth of the matter is we were designing this stuff ourselves with the help of a couple freelancers here and there, because I was the core customer. I'm like, I'm making it for me. This is obvious. T-shirts. The next thing we needed to make, hoodies. Long sleeve t-shirts. I knew intuitively what needed to come next, but it was also not that hard to figure out. T-shirt, long sleeve t-shirt, hoodie. And I know how I want it to look. I know how I want it to fit. It was easy. When it gets into women's clothing, I don't know. Like, I can't honestly say I know what the fit should be, the style should be. It's like, I know who our consumer is. I know what the use case is, but I'm not arrogant enough to think, oh, don't worry, I know what this is supposed to be. I knew I didn't know. So when we started making women's clothing, we needed to lean on a designer who was, our choice was a woman who we felt understood, I guess, the ethos of our brand and the aesthetic of our brand, and lean on them. And so it was, you know, first it was a part-time contractor that helped us, and then getting into having full-time designers on our team and building a design team. But once we were able to afford having that team in place, that's when the women's line took off, because we had brilliant women designers who knew how to take our brand and design for the woman in mind. And they lead the vision now. We've been putting this money into marketing and into our product development for so long that more and more and more people know us, more and more people have bought from us. And the more people that have bought from you and want to come back, there's just more people coming back, more people telling their friends. It's just more and more and more. So it's just, I feel like we've sort of hit this like exponential blast in the past year. I mean, we're not going lighter on the marketing, we're going harder, but it doesn't take as much to get more because there's just so much more of us out there. More word of mouth, more people coming back. So we've sort of felt this like kind of explosion in the past couple of years.
Can you measure word of mouth from your female customer base versus your male customer base? Do you feel you get a better word of mouth from that demographic?
You see it with women's customers. You see more conversation online. I get alerts on Google from when people mention Unbound Merino anywhere. And I've noticed in the past couple of years, the frequency of Reddit conversations about our brand are way up, and they're all women's clothing. Men talk less about this stuff in general, at least from my vantage point, but I see it. And also, if you think about people who are social media influencer types or like to share the things that they bought, women do it, seem to do it more than men. So I think there's a little bit more of a conversation around stuff with our women customers that I'm noticing. I mean, this is not something I can measure with actual numbers or data. I'm just telling you, I do see it. It's very clear to me and very obvious. So that probably contributes a ton to it.
The 100 million number, to me, it makes my brain explode. It's so insane to me. And I feel like you're the type of person that, regardless of whether the company is doing 60 million, 100 million, 500 million, you're still the same guy. Like, how has this changed you? Has it changed you?
Zero, unless I'm delusional. But sometimes I sit there. I had this moment 2 days ago. We had this amazing meeting in our warehouse with our head of product, and we're looking at actual first samples of all the stuff that's coming out in the next year and a half. And I couldn't even believe this was our brand. And as I was looking around this team and how organized it was and how unbelievable this product was, it hit me. I'm like, we built this? Like, that's insane. I was humbled by how unreal the stuff I was seeing around me was. And sometimes I'll look at the numbers and I'll see it's like, whoa, $100 million in total cumulative sales, or what the revenue is this year, which will, you know, we think we can hit $60 million in sales. I see the number and I try to put myself back to the beginning and think of how astounding that would be to me. And it is. It feels insane sometimes when I stop and actually think about it. But the day-to-day feels normal to me because it's still the same. I'm still just calling up Dima. Like, Dima is my business partner. He lives across the street. I see him every day. We go for coffee. We talk about the business. It's no different than when we first started and the revenue was a fraction of what it is now. It's just buddies solving problems and hanging out and having fun. And now it's gotten bigger. Dima the other day said, it's like, we're the garage band who finally like hit it big. And like, we're just on this adventure together. So like, there's moments where it's like, you feel that it's like, you're able to do more and it's like bigger and you see your product on the street and people know who your brand is. And that stuff's like, whoa, that's cool. But it's the same. I feel like it's the same challenge, the same fun. It feels exactly the same today. We're just surrounded by more talent.
So to bring this conversation back full circle, going back to the origin story with you and Justin at Biz, you start Unbound with Andrew and Dima. Justin's still running Biz Media. And to my knowledge, he has now joined you. in Unbound? When did he join?
I'm so bad with timelines, but it was probably 2 years ago now.
And it's been
amazing.
Amazing. What is it about the dynamic in your case amongst best friends that has worked so well? I mean, you asked 10 people whether or not it's a good idea to go into business with your best friends. 9 out of 10 of those people will be like, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
In your case, incredibly well.
I think they're so wrong. It's insane. Conventional wisdoms, business and friendship don't mix. We're having the time of our lives. It's amazing. In fact, we have the time of our lives when the thing's failing. I've had little projects fail. I'm like, who cares? It's like, we had fun doing this. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And I asked Andrew, I'm like, why do you think this works? Like, really? It's like, by the way, it comes with challenges too. But like, why do you think this works? Like, us working as best friends, running a business, why is that a good idea when everyone says it's a bad idea? He's like, well, and this sounds like a very simple answer, but it's true at the core. He's like, well, you like your friends, right? Like, yeah. He's like, well, isn't it fun to go to work with people you like? Yeah. Like, that's great. You spend more of your waking hours working than you do anything else. Why would it be a bad idea to want that to be with your best friends? Now people say, oh, well, what if the business doesn't work out? Well, that's not a friendship issue. That's a business issue. And in fact, if you get into business with your friends, it's most likely going to fail because most businesses fail. Mm-hmm. Just don't blame your friends. Just give it your best shot. Make sure you have complementary skill sets. And if it works, it's incredible. You get to every day go through hard things and do it with people that you enjoy being around and have fun. And I think it's one of the biggest mistakes that, as far as like conventional wisdom goes, that you shouldn't do that. I think everyone should take a stab at trying to start a business with their friends. I would even go so far as to say it's an advantage because you work with your friends and they come with baked in core value alignment. Like, you guys have similar ways of being. You have similar ways of looking at the world. They say good business, you're hiring and firing on core values. Well, if you start it with your best friends, you guys start with a pretty good chance that you have alignment there.
What's next for you guys? What's next for the brand?
We're at the stage where some people think, whoa, should we be building this thing to sell? And I am so against it. I feel like, guys, this is so fun. We're making money. We enjoy being around each other still. We're not tired of this. I now feel like recently we've reset the vision and put the new goalposts because we got into this place where, you know, we've grown this 8-figure business. This is exactly what I wanted to do when we first started. I'm like, we'll build this business that makes money while we sleep. And it's going to be entirely direct to consumer. And I'll be able to go to bed at night and the cash register will ring and all that stuff. And one day, maybe it'll be an 8-figure business. And then I got here and I'm like, whoa, that's pretty cool. But now I'm here. And we had to reassess, well, where do we go from here? And I think when I look around at the team, and I see how much talent is right around me at all times, I feel like there are some brands that become the greats, you know? They could be like one of the great brands for what they do. And I see us being there. And I'm like, that's sort of the next thing. It's like, how do we take it to the point where we're just kind of universally known and we establish a whole new lifestyle for merino wool clothing? And that's us. Like when people think of merino wool apparel, that's not the base layer for skiing or the shirt you go portaging in, they think Unbound. That's like the premium merino wool, high quality, timeless, classic kind of clothing. Maybe we'll have stores, maybe we won't, but I see us being that. And for the first time, I think we have the team that can get us there. And I want to be a part of that. I don't want to sell. I don't even get why people are so obsessed with selling. It's like, it makes some money. I'm like, just do the thing. This is the fun part. So I'm stoked on that.
Incredible. It's been an unbelievable journey to watch. Over the course of 9 years, it's really remarkable. Congrats, man.
Thank you.
And thanks for spending the time.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for tuning in to Shopify Masters. Drop us a comment and some feedback right here below. Make sure you're subscribed, and we'll see you at the next interview.